sailor, tucked these under his arm, and he was expected to find all the answers. So my time goes back with the navigators before, as I say, there was any of these things reduced to writing. In fact, I remember the Saturday afternoon over in Dawson Trotman's home that the topical memory system was put together for the first time. He and one of his assistants, a fellow named Louis Coates, memorized scriptures and kept them in a file box by topics. They also did the same thing with their jokes. They had them on cards, too. But they just said, you know, maybe we ought to pick out the best of these and kind of pass them along to the fellows. So it wasn't the most spiritual meeting in history as they were doing this. They'd get a big argument about what was the best verse and what wasn't. So finally, they ended up with a pile on the table, and that was the first topical memory system that the navigators ever had in handwriting. Dawson Trotman felt for many years that writing a verse was the key to memorizing it. So he would not allow any printed version to be handed out. Everybody had to produce their own because that was an aid in memory. Well, I got acquainted back in, went to his home the first time in 1933. So that would make it just about 40 years ago. Most of the other fellows, in fact, all five of them who preceded me, left the service just as soon as they could get out. They didn't realize what a wonderful opportunity this was to grow and to serve Christ. So they all backslid. But as Dawson Trotman and I looked it over, it seemed like that the key to the ministry advancing in the military was to have an inside man. So after the expiration of my first 4 years in the service, I voluntarily stayed in for the explicit purpose of serving the Lord first and the navigator second. So that ran from 1933 to 1956. In the late 1955 and 56, Dawson Trotman began to put the heat on me to get out, come and join the staff here at Glen Eyrie. Glen Eyrie was pretty new in the hands of the navigators at that time. I remember we met in Richmond, Virginia, and he really put the pressure on. And I said, you know, this is really kind of amusing to me that it's about 22 years ago, there was the same kind of pressure. But the pressure was to stay in. Now the pressure is to get out. What's changed? And I explained to him how happy I was at the peak of my military career, everything right there. But he always had a verse for everything. And before I had the words out of my mouth, he said, every branch in me that bears fruit, he purges it, that it may bring forth more fruit. And that was kind of it. So I made arrangements as soon as possible to leave the service, come out here and join him. I went to Scroon Lake, New York, in June of 1956 to work out the details. I arrived on Tuesday morning to find that he had gone to be with the Lord on Monday. So that was quite a disappointment to me because my whole future, the next step in my future, depended on what we worked out. But Lauren Sanney, who was the vice president, was aware of what we had been working on, and so he put a different kind of pressure on. Well, I was glad to respond. So I've been here at the headquarters since 1956 in various capacities. And I was thinking about, Chuck, what was the summer you spent here? As a 64, as a trainee. And every time I take a look at Chuck, I think, you know, how poor my advice is and how glad I am that people don't always take it. Because Chuck had a, I don't know what you call it, to go into the Navy in 64. You don't call it a scholarship, but a Naval Reserve. Come right up to the point, you know, to go in on active duty. And I know we talked about it and prayed about it and decided that was the thing to do. So Chuck left to go down to get inducted into the Navy. Next thing I heard, he hadn't. Well, it wasn't a big enough challenge to him. He had to get in the Marines.
You know, I gave me some very objective counsel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was real good. And now that Chuck has brought that up, if he and Gid would like to put their fingers in their ears, I'd like to tell you something about the Marines. Would you like to hear it and have them do that?
Yeah.
Will you guys promise not to listen? You know, in our military work down in the Southeast, there are lots of Marines. And I heard one of our fellows say once, in fact, there'll be far more Marines than any other of the services in heaven. And the explanation is that there's so few that reach the age of accountability. But there's always the exceptions, and we've got the most of them on our staff, the exceptions. Now, the Navigators wouldn't be what it is today without the influence of all these great Marines that we have. And you notice that I didn't say ex-Marines. There's no such thing as an ex-Marine. Early in our days with the Navigators, we had the privilege of hearing about all the great men of God that were in existence. I think they used to all come to Southern California. Dawson Trotman had a good in with all of them. They'd come for a conference, and then they'd spend more time with the servicemen than they did in the conference for which they came. One of these we used to listen to was Mr. L.L. Legters. Now, I know that with Wycliffe translators, Cameron Townsend is called the founder. But he took over from a man named L.L. Legters, who was the real founder of Wycliffe translators. He got his early missionary training and work among the Indians and was a very graphic teacher. As he spoke, his wife was in the same room with a blackboard, and she would write the outline as he spoke. Once in a while, Dr. Legger's mind would wander a little bit, and he would hesitate, and she would supply the word. She had heard him give his stuff so many times that if he hesitated a minute, she supplied the word. He would pick it up and go right ahead. Now, the reason I mention that tonight, as I look around the room and see some of the people here, you know, Mike and Chuck and Gid and Debbie and Patty and Marilyn and Dave and a few others, I know that some of the things I'm going to say you've heard many, many times. So if I miss a word, you just fill in, then we go right ahead. Is that okay? Now let's see here what my subject is for tonight. Now, Chuck, I thought when we talked, it was supposed to be the omniscience of God. But this is written down here, the omnipotence of God. But it doesn't make any difference because I've got a message that I call the greatness of God. About 2 weeks ago, I was asked to speak on the sovereignty of God, so I changed the heading in here and called this the sovereignty of God. And so for tonight, I changed it to the omniscience of God. But now that I see you on the chart and you said it's the omnipotence of God, well, we'll call it the omnipotence of God, okay? But I'm afraid it will be slant a little bit toward the omniscience of God. After all, how do you separate these things? The reason I felt at liberty to change it the other night when I was asked to speak on the sovereignty of God, I know how subjective all of us are, and really the reason people are interested in the sovereignty of God is how does that affect me? So I think when we're thinking about the omniscience of God, how does that affect me? And when we're thinking about the omnipotence of God, how does His omnipotence affect me? So no matter what we call it, we're going to bring out how God being who He is affects you. That'll be the main application. Now the first thing I want to mention here, and we're going to go a long way in a lot of directions in these next few minutes, and I think we've got a few mind stretchers in here. So we'll start out with the first one. I didn't notice how the weather was out here tonight. Anybody look at the stars? Nobody looked at the stars, or looked four stars as you came in. Well, we do have some here in Colorado. But before you leave, if you'll look out in this direction, you should be able to spot Polaris. Now, Polaris has another name. What's the other name that we call Polaris? North Star. Everybody knows where it is, where those two pointers on the Big Dipper go toward it. Well, if you look up at the North Star this week, you'll see some light, and you'll say, that's the North Star. But it really isn't, because the light that you see left there 75 years ago. The North Star could have been extinguished 75 years ago, and we wouldn't know it. Traveling at the speed of light, what's that, 186,000 miles per second? That light's been traveling for 75 years to get here. Now, what I'm going to suggest here, and I think our minds can follow this, suppose that you could get aboard a spaceship that had the capability of traveling just a little bit more than the speed of light, and it was a beam rider, and it would fasten on to that beam that's coming from the North Star, and you got aboard, started on a journey. Which birthday would you come to next? Your last one or your next one? Which would you arrive at first? Yeah. Okay, you'd repeat the one you just had. Okay, what's the next one you come to? Okay. So what would happen in time? Wouldn't be very long before you'd pass up the date of your birth. Is that right? That's exactly the way it would be. Okay. The first point on the omniscience of God is that He never sees events one after another in order. Every time He takes a look at you or me, He sees our total life at a glance. He knows everything, but He doesn't know any order. In our way of thinking, two follows one and three follows two. But He sees the whole system all at once. Now, that's encouraging to me, because I get discouraged at certain points of my life. And if God saw just that, I think He would get discouraged and call it quits. But remember, God never sees a single incident in your life apart from the whole picture, from birth to death to eternity. And we're going to get over what He sees beyond in a little bit. Now, this concept can save you a lot of trouble in the future when you get into controversy about foreknowledge and predestination and all this kind of thing. Because God doesn't see one event after another. He just sees the whole thing every time that He looks. So in His omniscience, He knows everything. Now, do you want to argue with that concept a little bit? Well, think it over, you know, for a week or two before you argue with it. I think you'll find that it's a great spiritual blessing, personally, to know that this is always what happens. And God hasn't given up on you. And when you have a low period, He isn't going to give up, because He sees beyond that. The whole life at a glance, every time. Well, that's introductory. Now to get right into the heart of the greatness of God, we're going to talk about two areas, the greatness of His person and the greatness of His interest in you. And these are really the same thing. Psalm 145:3 tells us that His greatness is unsearchable. So we will not by any means exhaust it tonight. It's unsearchable. But we want to be practical. So we'll start with Psalm 147, verse 4. And just tucked in there is a little phrase that He knows the number of the stars. Do astronomers know the number of the stars? Well, they've put a few facts together, put them in the computer, and have made an estimate of how many stars there are. Do you know how many that is? 10 to the 28th. 10 with 28 zeros. They think that's a pretty good number. God was talking with Abraham one day over in Genesis. He was illustrating to him how great the population of his own seed was going to be, the expansion of his own seed. And that's Genesis 15:5, and again in Genesis 22. I don't have the verse written down here. Yeah, 22:17. Where in the same sentence, he said, like the stars of the heavens and the sands of the sea. And instead of saying or, he said and. Now that may be significant. In the light of the fact that it's reported that Sir James Jeans, a British scientist, set out to estimate how many grains of sand there were on all the seashores of the world. Without any knowledge of what the astronomers had come up with. In fact, he preceded them, I believe. His solution was 10 to the 28th power, of how many grains of sand there were on all the seashores of the world. So, there are a lot of stars. And that gives us a better concept, I think, if we think, well, there's as many as there are grains of sand on all the seashores of the world. My wife used to tell me, I think this is before we were married, about the young man and the young woman that were out under the stars one night. And she said, aren't they multitudinous? And he says, yeah, they certainly are, and there's a lot of them, too. So, there's a lot of them. But God knows the number. Now, there's something else in Scripture that God knows. And preceding this is a very interesting illustration in Matthew 10:29 and Luke 12:6, if you want to compare these two. Christ always used local illustrations. And I think their version of the supermarket in the day he lived wasn't quite the same as ours is today. But the two supermarkets were in competition. They had a sale on. And the product was sparrows. So let's look in these two passages and see what the price was, the going price in the two places. Matthew 10:29, Luke 12:6. What was the going price in Matthew? Two for a farthing. Okay, now let's see. This farthing on my left hand, and it's two sparrows over here. Okay, what did the competition have? Luke 12:6. Two farthings, how many do you get? Five. What's the bargain? One bird free. If you lay down 2/8 of a cent, 1/4 cent, yeah. Apparently, a sparrow wasn't of a real great value either to the shop owner or the customer. Give me another 1/8 cent and I'll throw in one extra. But Christ said, not one of them falls to the ground without your Father's knowledge. You've heard the song many times, His Eyes on the Sparrow, isn't it? Then he said, verse 31, "You are of more value than many sparrows." And to illustrate that, he said, "In fact, the hairs of your head are all numbered." God not only knows the number of the stars, and he doesn't know, he knows all about all the sparrows, but he knows the number of hairs in your head. Anybody in the room that knows how many you've got? Dave raised his hand. I'm just looking around here. I've got a couple of twin boys that are 22 years of age, and they're both trying to raise a mustache, and I asked one of them the other day, well, that was a football or a baseball mustache he had. I don't know, what's the difference? I said, well, the baseball is 9 on the side and the football is 11 on the side. But this is what Christ said. "You're of more value than many sparrows." God knows the number of hairs in your head. Now we want to point out some more things that he knows about you. Let's suppose that during this time that you're here this week, there's a crime of some kind committed on this property. And it's serious enough that the law gets involved. So we tell the police and they send a detective out. Well, you know, he'll seal off the area, go around with his microscope and all of his other gear. If he can find a human hair there, he will race back to the laboratory in town. Then he'll get the names of everybody who was present this week, ask for a sample of a hair out of everybody's head. He can go into the lab and identify who was at that spot. Because the hairs of her head are not only numbered, but they're all classified different from everybody else's. So God knows the number, and he knows the classification of the hair of your head. If he finds one someplace, he can tell who it belongs to just by looking at it. Now, of course, if the detective could find a fingerprint, that'd be a good clue, wouldn't it? Because everybody's fingerprints are distinctive. Now, if we had a candid camera set up, so whoever was there tripped the shutter and took a picture, that'd make it easy, wouldn't it? It's been pointed out that God only had 18 square inches with which to work, and yet he made everybody's countenance different from everybody else's. The question has been asked, will we know one another in heaven? And somebody came back with a rather quick answer and said, well, we do now, don't we? Do you think we'll be less intelligent in heaven than we are here? But how do we know one another? There's really just one distinctive feature, isn't it? What is it? It's the countenance. God made everybody different from everybody else with only 18 square inches of surface with which to work. Now, if there were a tape recorder present, and the person who was there and shouldn't be had spoken a few words and had been recorded, all the detective has to do, take that in the laboratory, get a sample recording of everybody's voice, play it back on an oscilloscope, and he can identify your voice, because everybody has a different audio frequency, different from everybody else. That's how distinctive we are. And God knows that audio frequency. Now, if there were a very sophisticated electronic instrument present, and the person who committed this crime exercised his brain a little bit while he's thinking about what to do, and that instrument could measure his brain wavelength, And then he could take that recording in the laboratory. And then he'd get one on each one of us. He could tell who was obscene. Because every individual has a brain wavelength which is further separated from everybody else than our fingerprints are separate from one another. God knows all these things about us, just as he knows the number of the stars, the hairs of her head, and so forth. You want to carry this step further? I talk about this every once in a while, and people are always feeding me information. Doctors say that fingerprints and every other method of identification should be abandoned in favor of the retina of the individual eye. He said its characteristic is so distinctive that it's a positive means of identifying a person by that. But medical science is not through there. They have also found out that every human being has his own little flock of bacteria that are hopping on and off, and you never get rid of them. I mean, they're serious about this. If you go to the scene, get a sampling of the bacteria, then you take all the suspects, get a sample, and you can identify who was there just by the bacteria that is hopping on and off of all the time. Well, look at Psalm 139, a few verses there also. That's going to work up in application a little bit. We're just laying the basics here. You know, you're a very relaxed bunch, and that makes me relaxed, and so it's going to take longer than if I was trying to get it over with. Psalm 139, 2 through 6. Mike, that wouldn't have been a chance to be a Revised Standard Version you've got there.
It's New American Standard, yeah.
Oh. Oh, you're still sticking with that, huh?
Yes.
Would you read verses 2 through 6?
Okay. Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou dost understand my thoughts from afar. Thou dost scrutinize my path and my lying down, and art intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, thou dost know it all. Thou hast enclosed me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it.
Well, there's a few things in there we didn't mention. What are some of them? What does he know?
What time I get up in the morning, what time I go to bed.
Okay, and what else? What? Thoughts? What else? Okay. You read one thing there. He knows the thoughts, and he knows the vocabulary just before you speak it, before it's formed into words. Isn't that what he said? So the psalmist said, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. We're talking more about omniscience than omnipotence. But I don't want to let you down completely in this, so let's deviate just a little bit. Is that all right? If we just kind of jump back and forth, okay. Psalm 33. This isn't my notes. Maybe we'll never get back to the notes here. I hope we will. Since there's a lot of scientists in the room here tonight, is that right? I was in Japan several years ago and visiting my friend Dan Pyatt, who was getting ready for the Graham Crusade over there. And he's kind of a gadgeteer, and I'm kind of a gadgeteer. And I said, Dan, what's the latest thing the Japanese have come up with? And Dan said, you'd never believe it. Try me. He said, electronic furniture. He said they are able to program a signal in and out of a computer into a transmitter, and they can create a sofa, a chair, a bed, anything they can think of, and set it up in the room. Now, won't that be a great day for housekeeping? Where that when you get ready to clean the room, you know, I'm not going to say when the ladies clean the room, because we live in a society that's equal in every respect here. But any of you get ready to clean the room, all you have to do is just go over and throw the switch, and it all disappears. And when you go to furnish the room, if you've got a good enough computer, you just decide where you want to push the button. Here's the table, here's the chair, here's the bed, and it will reappear. But Dan says they've got a problem. It is invisible. He says they're trying to program color into it. And he says, you know, I think they'll do it. Well, when I realize that there are a number of color signals going through this room right now, transmissions. We brought in a TV set where we could bring their frequency down to one we could comprehend in our video and audio range. We could see what's going on any place in the world, almost, couldn't we? In color, natural color. Well, that's quite an accomplishment, isn't it? Be able to transmit that. Now, I don't know what progress they're making. I asked Dan the last time I saw him, I said, hey, have you done any follow-up on that thing you told me? And he said, no, I really haven't. But he said, I'm going to. I don't know where he got his information. Well, I was talking about this to a group of students once. And I said, you know, over in Hebrews 11, we find out how God formed the world. Remember that verse? Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. And Psalm 33:6 says, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. How did God bring the world into existence? According to this. Well, if you can push a button and generate an electrical field that has shape, stability, and color, don't you think God could do that? So he just spoke the word, and all these molecules lined up. So that's what the earth and universe is. It's an electrical field, is it not? That has shape, stability, and color. And if you want to trace this through a little bit, you go over to 2 Peter 3, and you find out that one of these days he's going to turn off the switch. And when he turns off the switch, the whole thing's going to collapse, just like you brought it in. Well, I'll get back to my notes here. Psalm 147. Oh, the only waste is just the electricity that's consumed while it's being put on. Okay, then he not only knows the number of the stars, but he knows the names of the stars. Do you think that he knows your name tonight? Throughout Scripture, this is very prominent, that God called people by name. Remember over in Judges chapter 7 and verse 10, that Gideon was to pick out somebody to go on a reconnaissance tour with him. And you know what God said to Gideon? He had an army of 32,000. Originally it was down to 300. He says, take Phurah with you. He didn't say, take that tall, skinny one or the short one. Take Phurah. He knew his name. Mary, you remember, after the resurrection, thought it was the gardener fooling around. And she said, if you know what they've done with him, let me know. And he said, Mary? Well, Mary knew that the gardener didn't know her name. And the minute she heard her name, she turned around. Chuck mentioned that we have a 12-year-old that's still at home. And the other day she mentioned something to me about her math teacher. And I said, you were having a little problem with him earlier in the term. How are things now? And she said, oh, everything's fine. And then she said, he knows my name. And that made everything just fine, you know, that he knew her name. Well, God not only knows your name, but according to Revelation 2:17, he knows something else. And what is that? You see it? I want to make you do some of the work here tonight. What's he given to every believer? What's it say? Yeah. Revelation 2:17.
He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden man, and I will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, except he that receiveth it.
What's he got for every Christian? A new name. And what's distinctive about it? Well, we want to catch this. It is a name that is unknown except to God and you. So sometime during eternity, if you hear this name spoken, you'll immediately know two things. What are they? Who's speaking? And you know something else. What? You know who's speaking, you know something else too. That there's nobody else within earshot. Because this is an eternal secret. If you ever hear the name, you know two things. You're all alone. Is that right? Isn't that what it says here? I was watching a TV program one time, and the MC was trying to get the people kind of relaxed. So he asked the lady, he said, "Does your husband have a special name for you that he has never called you in anybody else's presence? Nobody knows but the two." She got real flustered and embarrassed, as if to say, "How did you know?" Well, he saw that he had gotten on to something, so he said, "What is it?" You know what she said? He said, "I'm not going to tell you. That's our secret." So God not only knows the number of the stars and the names of the stars, all these things about you, he knows your present name, and he knows the new name that he's already given you. That's what it said there, wasn't it? Revelation 2:17. In 1 Corinthians 15:41, we read that every star differs from every other star in glory, in its radiation. Every one of them is different. Every star in the universe, and there's many of them, radiates its energy on a different frequency. That's what it says. God has a different purpose for every star. Now, I've been giving you the truth up to this point. I'd like to speculate a little bit as we expand this point and go over to Job chapter 38 and verse 7. Speaking of the creation, and there's an amazing thing here. He said, when the stars sang together or made music together. Do you read these articles about what do you call them, radio astronomers? They are cataloging at the rate of 5 a month of quasar signals, which are manufactured signals coming in from outer space. They have a, you know, the way we control the frequency of a signal that we use in communication is through an oscillator. Well, these things all come from a giant oscillator, and every one of them is on a different and identifiable frequency. Well, they haven't found any meaning or message to them yet, but you know what I think is going to happen? One of these days, they're going to program one of these into an amplifier, and they're going to find out what real music sounds like. When God set Adam and Eve in the garden, he had the greatest symphony that's ever been put together playing background music. You see, there's a reason that we're stereo oriented. We inherited it from Adam. Now, when Adam sinned, the band, his audio band, was reduced down to so narrow, it can't be measured. When we get our glorified body, we're going to hear it again. They're still playing out there. Every star has a purpose. And the indication seems to be that it contributes a note to the symphony. Did you hear about the high school band that was giving its first concert? And one of the fellows had lost his program. He said to the next one, "What's our next number?" And he said, "That's the Star Spangled Banner." "Oh, I just played that." Well, if you've heard a high school band giving its first concert, that could happen, couldn't it? Well, there's a point behind this, and that is, it's only as every instrument contributes the right note, the right time, that you have harmony. Is that right? God not only knows the purpose of the stars, He knows the contribution to the harmony, the symphony that every one of us to make. He created a different frequency for every one of us. But He knows the purpose for which He created you. Now back to Psalm 139 again. We get a glimpse in Psalm 139 into what I would call God's personality factory. Verse 14, He says, "I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." I heard several years ago about a preacher who announced what scripture he was going to read the following Sunday. So a couple of boys in his congregation thought it would be fun to play a trick on him. So they pasted the next few pages together. So Sunday morning he got up there in his big pulpit Bible, and he was going to read in Genesis about the creation of Adam and Eve. So he read it, you know, male and female created He them. Turned the page, 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits high. So he turned back, you know, he read it again. That's what it came out. He said, "Now I'll have to confess that I've never seen this in the Bible before." But he says, it, you know, he's a good navigator. He needs cross-references. He says it just goes to verify that verse over in Psalm 139, which says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. But Psalm 139 is not talking about the body. It's talking about the eye, as you'll see all through these verses. Let me illustrate this. In industry, the most carefully guarded secret is the Coca-Cola formula. Competitors have spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to duplicate it, but they can't. I read an article a while back which pointed out that there are only two people that know it. And in case something happens to them, it's locked up in a safe in Chicago, a fireproof safe. The Coca-Cola company actually sends detectives around. And they will buy a Coke, pour it in a bottle, take it back to the lab, and if it doesn't meet the specifications, well, the person will lose his franchise that's putting it up. They don't want it to vary in the least. I've traveled in many parts of the world, but I've never been in a place that Coca-Cola wasn't there first. With God, it is exactly opposite. They have a list down here in this place we're talking about of formulas combining genes and chromosomes. Got a whole bunch of them. And the minute one is used, it is retired, and it is never used again. Every formula for a human personality is different. I was talking this over with some students down in Australia a couple years ago. One of them came up later and said, "You know, in our class, in genetics, we figured out what the genetic possibilities are. He's before duplication. God knows how to create variety. What I'm saying is, he said that every star differed from every other, didn't he? So, every person differs from every other. There is nobody who ever arrived in the world by accident. We are the result of a plan. See, people ask the question every once in a while, what do you suppose God's been doing throughout eternity? Well, I heard a good scriptural answer one day. This unbeliever said the other, he said, well, now you claim to know a lot about God. Tell me, what's he doing right now? So he just quoted in James 4:6. God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. He says that's what he's been doing ever since he created man. Resisting the proud, giving grace to the humble. So that's what he's doing right now, just all over the world. But do you think God's brain's been active down through eternity? He will tell you in this psalm, before we get through here, where his concentration has been. Up to now, the greatest mathematical number we've had are the number of grains of sand on all the seashores. Look what he says, 17. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them, if I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. So what does God reserve, the greatest number that he uses in Scripture to describe? The amount of thought he's put in to you. In the creation and in the future. Now, according to human standards, that took a little time, didn't it? Isn't that what it says in here? Now, I don't want to tell you something about it. When I'm speculating, I'll tell you. I'm speculating on the stars making music, although I think there's some grounds for that, but I'm not here. Is that right? So, he designed every one of the stars to radiate its energy on a certain frequency. But that didn't, man, he did that off the back of his, you know, top of his head. But he put a lot of thought into the arrangements and of genes and chromosomes that was to make up you. And he has projected what he has in mind, not just to where you are right now, but what he has in mind for you throughout all eternity. And if the clock doesn't move too fast, we're going to jump into that realm. And maybe this would be a good time, Chuck, to pause a little bit. Maybe everybody stand up and stretch, and I'm just getting started. I want to keep going here. Okay? And we kind of reminded that Christ gave Nicodemus just a few simple scientific facts. And Nicodemus said, how can these things be? Well, how can these things be? Now, I'd like to talk about the human brain a little bit. Neurosurgeons agree that nobody's brain has been used more than 10%. And the average is closer to 2% of the amount of our brain that's developed. And yet, to build a computer that could duplicate the work that the human brain does, has been pointed out, would take a building the size of the Empire State Building to house. It would take all the electrical energy that Niagara Falls creates to work it, and would take all the water in the Niagara River to cool it. That's one computer that could duplicate what the human brain does. I asked a very famous neurosurgeon about this one day. He's a Christian. And I said, how efficient is the brain? I hear that it's only 2% developed. He says, there are areas that are totally undeveloped. You know, he says, that's being generous to say that 2% of it is developed. I said, could you give me a comparison? He said, well, the computer I work with, and he was in a university faculty where they didn't have much money, I guess, but he says, it has 20,000 vacuum tubes in my computer. But he says it can only keep track of 4,000 bits of information. He said that inefficient old brain you're talking about, it can retain 10 to the 23rd power bits of information in it. 20,000 vacuum tubes, only 4,000 items. So he agreed that it's not very well developed, but in its undeveloped state, compared to a computer, it's a pretty efficient instrument. I read of an experiment a while back where some neurosurgeons got permission from a hospital to put probes on the brains of two persons that were expected to die that night. The purpose of their experiment was to determine what happens to brain energy at the moment of death. Now, unknown to the neurosurgeons, one of these persons was a real reprobate, dying from the results of venereal disease. The other was a Christian woman. So they hooked up the probes. Well, when the man died, as life left him, the meter dropped down to zero. As the woman died, she was praying and praising God. And the meter flew up to the top range with such force that it almost knocked it off the stops. And if it had stayed like that, it would have burned the meter out. You know, that's what they said. Well, after this information was published, there was, you know, people write in all about it, and they said it couldn't happen, it would burn out the meter, this, that, and the other. Well, if I hadn't been too lazy, I'd have written in my response to it. Because I think I know what happened. There was an instant in which that woman's old body and her new body were superimposed. And what that thing measured was the energy in her new brain, in her new body. Now, let me give you another illustration. Dr. Edmond, president of Wheaton College. Some of you might have read some of his books. He had a period of 2 weeks in his life when he was a missionary in Ecuador. He had a tropical disease. The doctors were so sure he was going to die that they bought a coffin, set it outside his bedroom door. Mrs. Edmond dyed her wedding dress black to get ready for the funeral. For sanitary purposes, the body had to be in the grave within 4 hours after death. You know, so they had to, you know, plan ahead. So for 2 weeks, as he wrote it down, he said, I spent more time on the other side of eternity than I did this time. So I was sitting next to him at dinner one night in a meeting, and I said, Dr. Edmond, I shouldn't have done this, you know, I approached it the wrong way. I said, do you ever talk about that experience? Or do you, like Paul, who said that, you know, what he found when he was caught up was unlawful for him to utter. And Edmund said, I feel like Paul. I said, I should never give him that suggestion. He said, my wife and I are very close, but I have never shared the intimate details of that experience. They're too personal and private. Well, I'd heard about another person that had an experience similar to this, and he told me, he said, what impressed me the most was I felt like I was getting out of a straitjacket. He said, I never was you know, conscious of being cramped up, but all of a sudden, you know, just liberated. Then he said, I had always associated the right arm with my physical body and the left arm with my physical body, my right ear and my left ear. And he said, you know, my soul was clothed with the exact configuration of my human body, except it was a vastly superior substance. It was made out of. Configuration was the same. I wasn't naked, just a body like the old one, except it was superior. So I decided, man, I don't want to miss this opportunity with Edmund. So I said, now, was that the same sensation you had? And he says, come to think of it, yes. But he says, that's what not what really impressed me. I said, what impressed you? I think I did. At least I got it back. He said, what impressed me most? Whenever I was in that new body, there wasn't a question I could think of that the answer wasn't instant. There wasn't a problem that could come to mind that the solution, the answer, wasn't instant. Now, you know what I think happens? We've got a lot of information stored down here. Articles that I've read on the brain says it works just like a computer. If I had a blackboard up here, we'd illustrate it. I'll just do it in thin air. The brain is supposedly has 100 billion glial cells, between 10 and 20 billion neuron cells. When you think, you generate a little, almost unmeasurable amount of electricity. And if you're trying to memorize something, like telephone number, as you concentrate on it, the neuron cell shoots a beam of electricity across to a glial cell. If you concentrate hard enough, it builds an electronic bridge. And then the glial cell draws the aminic acids out of the bloodstream and creates a new protein molecule. So you've got that telephone number that you memorized. It is actually, physiologically, a new molecule. Now, it's like a battery, however. It has to be charged. If you review it enough, it'll always be charged. If you don't review it, it'll fade out. That's the way the memory works. Thought generates a weak electrical charge. If there was very much electricity in the brain, because it's made out of flesh and blood, it would burn up, right? So I'll give you my theory. And that is, in the glorified body, the brain is composed of a substance that can conduct great amounts of electricity. So in a glorified body, you see, you can recall, sort everything out instantly, just like a computer. So Dr. Edmund said there wasn't a question I could think of. The answer wasn't instant. There wasn't a problem I could think of. The solution wasn't instant. Now, how can these things be? Well, God has not given man a duplicate of his brain. He's given a little replica. But you see, I believe all these things about the great God. He knows the number of the stars, the names of the stars, the purpose of the stars, and he knows the number of hairs in your head and your fingerprints and the genes and chromosomes and the purposes. And anytime he wants to, he has instant recall of the whole thing. How can these things be? God has a real brain. Now, you know what Dr. Edmund told me next? He said, but that's not what really impressed me. He said, what really impressed me was the intensity of my emotions. I thought, he said, I had the ability to love God and love people and hate sin. But he said the intensity of my emotions were so great, it is simply indescribable. I just can't describe it. You know, some people say the reason that we're going to get a new body when Christ comes is that the old one would vibrate to pieces and fall apart. You know, just through the rapturous experience. Can't take it. Fall apart. God's got to give us a new one. I was talking with a university student up in Seattle one day. We were talking about some of these things, and he said, I said, I don't think you and I are, we don't have the same vibes. He said to me, floating around on a cloud waving a halo throughout all eternity doesn't sound too exciting. So I told him what I've just told you. I said, you know, you're trying to gratify the appetites and desires and aspirations of an eternal soul utilizing a brain that's about as efficient as a burned-out light bulb, and through a flesh-and-blood heart that's about as effective as a burned-out resistor in electronic component. Eternity is not floating around on a cloud waving a halo. It is experiencing every desire and ambition of a brain and every aspiration of a soul. But a brain made out of flesh and blood, and a brain and a heart made out of flesh and blood, cannot radiate eternal things. Now, shall we go a step further in this? You know, space travel is very frustrating, even the idea. For a person to go to the moon and say that I've traveled in space, you figure this out. Suppose you're going to go on a round-the-world trip. One of your friends knows it. And he happens to run a service station 2 miles down the road. And you stop for a fill-up. He says, how are you coming on your round-the-world trip? And you say, well, I'm well on my way. I'm 2 miles from home. When man got to the moon, he was just about the same distance from Earth in space travel as you would be 2 miles from home on a round-the-world trip. A couple weeks ago, we had one of the astronauts. He's a Christian, Jim Irwin. Lives here in Colorado Springs. Billy Graham sent him to Billy Graham to get him studied in Scripture, Remember, and Bible study. So Lauren meets with him man to man. He's got a good testimony. He's one of the few people that's ever traveled 25,000 miles an hour. Well, I mean, what is there, less than 20 of them that have done it? Fastest man's ever traveled is in returning to Earth. Now, if one of the Apollo crews had said, while we're out here, why don't we look around a little more? In fact, let's take a trip, side trip, to the closest star, Alpha Centauri, at 25,000 miles an hour. You know how long it'd take? 3,000 years to get there, and 3,000 back to get to the nearest star next to our sun. So, as I said, people that are trying to travel in space are totally frustrated, but they have a hope. They're working on something. And it is called the dematerialization of matter. And they're making some progress. With a computer, it is possible to program the exact configuration of a human body. And having programmed the configuration, they break it down into a beam of light, transmit it at the speed of light to another location, stop it, reassemble it. And it's just like it was before, except a different geographic place. So, for military uses and space travel, there's a lot of research going on, trying to find out how to do this. And as I said, a great deal of progress has been made, according to the reports I get back. So to travel in space, they've got to discover this secret, which they call also transpolarization. Now, in my lifetime, they may do it. When they do, I'm going to write a letter. If you hear about it before I do, let me know. I'm going to write a letter to the person in charge of the project and ask him if he will give me an explanation of John 6, verse 21. Now, I'm speculating now. Christ had been teaching about faith in himself for quite a while, and then he gave a test, and they all flunked it. So he decided they need a little vacation. So verse 21, right after they flunked the test, they were out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. I don't know what your translation says, but I know what mine says. Verse 21, it says, and immediately the ship was at the land where they went. That's what it says. Is that what yours says? Now, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not even going to say it could mean, but I say, could it mean that he moved himself, the ship, and the occupants from one place on the earth's surface to another with no loss of time? Could it be? Well, the topic of conversation the next day was, how'd you get here so quick? Isn't that what it says down below there? Now, one of these days, the Christian is going to get a new body. It's got a real brain and a real heart, and will not be subject to any natural or physical law. So, when we get ready to go down to Giuseppe's, you know, all Mike has got to do is just stand up and say to his pile of molecules, fall out, room 303, fall in, Giuseppe's. And that's exactly the way it'll happen. You better really think through on that. You know, somebody wants to know when Christ in John 11 raised Lazarus, he says, Lazarus, come forth. If he hadn't said Lazarus, the whole cemetery would have come out. He just said, come forth. But that's right, Ben. You better tell that pile of molecules where. Give them the address. Christ took great delight in ordering the molecules around. He went to a feast one time and they needed some wine, so he rearranged the molecules. One day there was a hungry bunch. He rearranged the molecules in the soil, made it bread. In John, 8:59, hostile crowds surrounded him one day. Everybody had a rock aimed at his head. It says he went through their midst. He just changed the frequency of his own body so it didn't collide with theirs and went right through them. Well, he walked on the water, law of gravity. He wasn't synchronized with it. And you remember after the crucifixion that all the disciples were gathered together. They closed the windows, boarded them up, put all the furniture against the doors so they wouldn't be next. And Christ, the doors being shut, came in. We have a man on our staff who got his master's degree in math at the University of Colorado. I was talking to him about this, and he said this is one of the projects we had, was to figure out the mathematical possibilities of collision between a human body and a wall. I know a scientist in Kansas City who's working on these things. He says, in my lifetime, we're going to discover how a human can go through a wall without having a collision. He says, we've already found out how to put your hand through. That's what he told me. And he says, it will not be a miracle. It's just a matter of a formula. And he said, we'll see how Christ did it. He just had knowledge of formulas that we don't have. But he says, we're going to have it in my lifetime. Well, I want to mention a couple other things here. Where is God? Where does he hang out? In Jeremiah 23:23, I'd like to hear Jeremiah preach this. God told him, go tell those people, I am a God at hand and not a God afar off. Now, if you ever get anything straight, get this straight. I'm not a God afar off. I'm a God at hand. One of you said you listened to a tape where I'd mentioned something. I'm going to mention it again. Irwin Moon, just retired the other day. Moody Institute of Science Films, he's the man who's produced all these films down through the years. He was talking with a famous scientist one day. He told a little group of us, three or four of us, about this. I don't know why he never did exploit it. It's mentioned in his film, but to me it's the greatest thing that he ever came up with. He said he asked this scientist, and if he's the one we think he was, it was Dr. Milligan who received the Nobel Prize for his work in physics that led to the splitting of the atom. He didn't identify him because Dr. Milligan was still alive at the time. But we think this is who it was. He said, "Do you believe in God?" And I won't say it was Milligan, but the other doctor said, "Yes, but not the way you do. What's your problem?" He said, "Is Abel in heaven?" And Irwin says, "I'm sure that he is." The scientist said, "How did he get there?" Irwin said, "I have no idea." The scientist said, "If he's been traveling at the speed of light for 6,000 years, he is only one-third the distance I've seen with my telescope. Assuming that heaven is located just beyond the range of my telescope, and that he's been traveling at the speed of light for 6,000 years, he's got 12,000 years to go to get there. That's my problem." Now, Irwin had a very good answer, and he said to him, "You have done more than any other person to popularize this idea that we've just been talking about the porosity of matter. If it's true that that wall is mostly space and this chair is mostly space, why can't I push the chair through the wall the same way I push my fingers through one another?" The doctor said, "I've tried it. It won't go through." But he said, "This I know. It's not because of the collision of solid particles. There's not that many of them. The mathematical chances of them colliding is too few. That isn't it." He says, "Now we assume that surrounding the solid particles, there is an electrical flux. And these electrical fields are on opposing frequencies. So that the collision that takes place, is really a collision of electrical fields and not of solid particles." So Irwin Moon says, "If that is true, would it be possible for two Earths to occupy the same space, same time, and neither be conscious of the other's existence if they were so synchronized they never collided?" Scientist thought for a minute. He said, "Not just two." He says, "There's room for hundreds of thousands to occupy the same space at the same time and none be conscious of the other's existence." Irwin Moon says, "I think you've answered your own question. I was reading this morning in Ephesians 2:6 that I am seated in heavenly places in Christ. To get to heaven, I don't have to travel the speed of light for 18,000 years. All I have to do is just change frequency." Now, this is a very logical explanation. Over in 2 Kings chapter 6, we find a situation in which the king of Syria was trying to ambush the armies of Israel. It sounds exactly like what's going on today. But every time the Syrian army showed up at an ambush, they found the Israeli reconnaissance patrol had gone right around it. So one day the king of Syria got his top staff together, and he said, "The only way they could be tipped off every time is that somebody in this room is a traitor. The purpose of the meeting is to find out who the traitor is." One of his staff spoke up, and he said, "It's not any of us. It's a man by the name of Elisha. He not only tells the king of Israel's what we discuss in our staff meetings, but he tells him what you say in your sleep." That's what it says. You read it, 2 Kings 6. So that's verse 12. He tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedchamber. So the king of Syria wisely decided, "We got to do away with him. Where is he? He's in Dothan." So they sent out an army and surrounded the city. Next morning, Elisha went out to have a quiet time. He took a young man with him that he was training. So they got out, and as soon as they finished their quiet time, they found that the Syrians had closed in on them on all sides. And here they were, ringed with all these armed Syrians. So the young man panicked, and he says, "What do we do?" Elisha said, "Fear not," verse 16, "for they that be with us are more than they that be with them." Now, I'm sure the young man had great confidence in Elisha's spirituality, but not too much in his mathematical ability at this point. Well, Elisha saw the problem. Verse 17 says, and Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes. Change his video frequency." And the Lord changed the video frequency of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Elisha never saw them. I don't think he knew they were there. But God changed that young man's video frequency, and he saw what was in the other realm. As Stephen was being stoned in Acts 7:55, he said, "I see the heavens open, and Jesus standing at the right hand of God." Do you think God gave him the ability to project his eyesight into space? Or do you think that the throne of God may be located in the vicinity of Jerusalem on a different frequency? By the way, how many meetings do you suppose are going on in this room? Psalm 34:7 says, "The angel of the Lord encamps round about them that fear him and delivers them." No parent, I'm sure Chuck would agree with me, believes that any one of his children would ever reach maturity unless they were guardian angels. Man, you just can't look after them. That's what it says. I have never heard an angel. I've never seen one. As far as I know, I've never collided with one. But I believe they're all around on a different frequency. Why doesn't God show himself? Very interesting. Moses had a very special relationship with God. Over in Exodus 33, now, after God had given him a promise, Moses said, "If I could just have a good look at you, it would really help out. I could really communicate better." And God told him, that's a great ambition. But he says, we can't work it out. Verse 20 of Exodus 33, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." But he said, "There's a rock there, and you get behind the rock." And he said, "I'll pass by and allow you to see not my face, but just as I go by." And he says, "And I'll take my hand, and you'll see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. I'll put you in a hole in the rock. As I go by, I'll put my hand over the rock. And as I disappear, you can see me go away." And, of course, the hymn writers have come up with a good hymn on that. "He hideth my soul in the cleft of the rock and covers me there with his hand." This is what he did. But as intimate a relationship as he had, God said, can't happen. Now, there's a reason for that. Over in Hebrews, we read 12:29, "Our God is a consuming fire." Hebrews 10:31 said, "It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God." Why? God operates on frequency holiness because sin has ruined our structure. Everything about us is in friction with God. For us to get in his frequency, or his to get on ours, would cause about the same thing if you stuck your two fingers in an 880-volt circuit. It is a great act of mercy that God stays on his frequency. He told Moses, as much as I'd like to, you see my face, you'll be cremated. He stays in his. He keeps us on ours. But when we get our new body, it'll be synchronized. We'll live, communicate, see the same realm that God's in. He's not a God afar off. He's a God at hand. One final thing. And hey, we're going to finish with time to spare unless there's some questions. During the Korean War, three jet pilots were up one day. An anti-aircraft missile of some kind came up, exploded right in the cockpit of one. The pilot was knocked unconscious and blinded. The other two people in the formation saw what had happened, and they had practiced this or worked it out. So they brought their jets up to where the jet exhaust was right under his wings, and they kept him level. And then one would get up high and one low, and they guided him back to the airstrip. In a little while, he regained consciousness, but he was blind. So they told him what they were going to do. And they coached him in to the airstrip. You know, they actually, with their jet stream, guided him down to where he landed on the runway. Now, that was quite a feat, wasn't it? But that's the way it is with us. Is that we can communicate with God, but we can't see him. But we can experience his response of our communication just the way those two wingmen took that guy down to the destination he wanted him. So we better not have a lot of ambition to see God, but we better believe that he's near and he's not a God afar off. Well, these are a few scattered thoughts on the greatness of God in these many realms. We cannot much less exhaust the subject. We really can't even get into it, can we? Okay, are there any questions or comments? Anybody have?
You can ask an intelligent one, so I won't tell you.
Okay. Charles, you're the chief honcho here.
Just give a few points on the, you talk about the brain. Do you remember when we were out at for the Princess Maria in Long Beach Harbor that time with the bunch of the food? You talked about that article that you read Newsweek about the brain and how the alcoholic and the could you share that about how the brain works in that area?
Yeah, that's got a real lesson in it. You know, just kind of off the top of the head here. There's been a lot of articles published in nearly every leading magazine. Life devoted four issues to the brain. Newsweek, a year ago July, had every leading article was by somebody that had something to say about it. And this Newsweek article, one writer attempted to make a connection with the will. They're talking about something different, you know, when you're talking about the brain and the will. So he was bold enough to try to make a connection. And he said that the brain is constantly feeding information to the will, making suggestions all the time. And then he said the will only has one criterion for responding, and that is, what's the pleasure element? What do I get out of it? When I read that, I said, boy, can I identify. In the morning, the alarm goes off, and the brain says to the will, now what's the most pleasant, to get up or to stay in bed? And the will always makes a decision on the pleasure factor. That's the only thing it considers. Now, you skip your quiet time for 3 or 4 days, you know, because it's easier to stay in bed than it is to get up, and then you get grouchy and lose the victory. and you decide, well, there's really more pleasure in having a quiet time than there is in skipping it. So you go back to it, or the pleasure factor. This is what the article said. Now, I hooked up this theory with a couple other observations I had made. And I think these are biblical. Now, this is purely theoretical, but I think it's a good theory. That when the brain, or the will rather, always makes the same response to the same suggestion, it loses its ability to make the opposite response. An alcoholic is not an alcoholic because a part of his brain has been destroyed. It's not the effects of alcohol. It's the result of the fact that he couldn't say no. So we lose the ability. That part of our brain, I don't know how to say, atrophies? Is that the right word? When it isn't used. So this is where habits come from. You see. By the time a person is 25, their course in life is pretty well set because they have determined what they're going to respond to, what they're not going to respond to. It is very difficult for a person to make a major change after 25. So, long before we decided, that was kind of the cutoff point. God knew it. People are impressionable from 18 to 25, but beyond that. Now, the reason I say that, you take any crowd you ever go into, ask them how many people in that crowd, that is, a representative crowd, came to Christ after 25, you will never find over 10%. 90% of all people who become Christians do so before they are 25 years of age. A person is pretty well set in his ways. Now, this has its good points as well as its bad. The person who makes the practice, never to deny Christ, sets up the same arrangement between the brain and the will. And it becomes almost impossible to deny Christ if you form the habit. Christ had a great deal to say about denying yourself. Now, I never understood that until I ran across this. The only way that you can keep any area of your life sharp that you want to have an option in is to rotate the options. Now, take the matter of diet. After you get to be 30 years of age, if you eat the same amount you did before you were 30, you'll get fat because the body's wearing out. You know, it doesn't need that much. It's over the hill and gone. So the only way that you can keep the victory over fleshly appetites is to always rotate the options. Then it's always sharp. But if you adopt one option, you're sunk on this. So I think that's an application. Christ said in certain areas you're to deny yourself. That keeps the options open. Keeps us sharp. Oh, I don't remember what else we talked about, Chuck. Was that the main things?
Yeah. The relationship of the mind and the will.
Yeah. Okay?
Well, probably around the lukewarm atmosphere around the
two more questions. Okay. Well, I feel like joining you. I didn't know whether I would or not, but I came in from